The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We are on Amazon, Stitcher, other podcast platforms under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Facebook, Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Twitter, WOWKUCIFM. And we both have websites. Barbara's is penonfire.com. Mine is mariestone.com. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their craft, their process, and sometimes, like today, craft and process itself, if the writer has written a book for other writers. And today's book is sort of an MFA graduate level text of writing. So I think you'll enjoy it. We often invite listeners to write in and tell us how we're doing, what they'd like us to do, who they'd like to hear. And today's show was inspired by one of those emails. Sarah Markser is a writer and listener who wrote in asking if I would invite Jane Allison onto the show. Jane wrote a craft book a few years back that just blew Sarah away and kind of changed the way she thought about writing, changed what she thought was possible in fiction. And when I read the book, I thought the same thing and wondered, you know, how we'd missed having her on a few years ago. So I wrote to Jane. She agreed to come on to talk about the book. Sarah submitted some questions for Jane that we're going to raise. And so again, I invite you to do that. If there's someone you want to hear, let us know. Our contact information is on our websites. We're delighted to entertain your ideas. Doesn't always work, but when it does, it's really pretty cool. Jane Allison's first novel, The Love Artist, was published in 2001 and has been translated into 7 languages. It was followed by 3 other novels, The Marriage of the Sea, Natives and Exotics, and a nonfiction novel, Nine Island. She's also published a memoir, The Sisters Antipodes, translations of Ovid's stories of sexual transformation, Change Me. She has collaborated with composer Thomas Sleeper on a mini opera, and a song cycle based on her books and her short fiction and essays have appeared in the Paris Review, the New York Times, Washington Post, International Herald Tribune, Boston Globe, Creative Nonfiction, on and on. Jane studied classics, both Greek and Latin, but primarily Latin, at both Princeton and Brown, which I mention because I suspect her knowledge of the classics is going to become evident in the conversation. And she studied creative writing at Columbia. Since 2013, she has been a professor of creative writing at the University of Virginia. Her latest book, the craft book, is Meander, Spiral, Explode, Design and Pattern in Narrative. It's published by Catapult. So the premise of the book, spoiler alert, is that the classic structure we've all been taught as writers and novelists, sort of the classic narrative arc, is only one way to tell a story. In fact, there are many other ways, many other patterns to storytelling, and those patterns can be used to great effect. So Jane shows us 8 of them with tons of examples and supporting evidence. That's what we're going to unpack this morning. Jane, welcome.
Thank you so much. What a wonderful introduction. And a special thanks to Sarah, you said, who read the book and asked me to be on. I appreciate it. I'm interested in the questions.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for doing this because I called you off this well-earned summer vacation and I know you're not on book tour to do this. So really, yeah, extra appreciation for taking the time out to do this. So you wrote 4 novels, a memoir, and translated a book before writing Meander, Spiral, Explode. And I suspect the memoir, maybe we can talk about this, got you thinking about patterns and structure. So maybe we can start off by you talking about your thinking about narrative structure before writing this book and how you went about it in those 4 previous novels and maybe how some of that thinking, you know, led to this.
Oh, wow. That is a great question. And there's going to be a lot in there to unpack and I will do my best. I think that it's interesting that you say that about the memoir being something that might've gotten me thinking about patterns, because I think you're absolutely right. One thing that memoirists do is, or as far as I know, in my experience, is that, you know, you're speaking from a present, looking back over a past, trying to find form and order and pattern in it. And so it sort of clarifies the mind in a way, in a retrospective manner, that is something that can happen as well when you do write fiction and maybe you've written a full draft. And then you also need to kind of look at the whole thing, see what it is and see whether you've got it moving in the way that you really want it to move. There's a word that I came upon when I started writing Meander Spiral, which took me a long time to find because I needed a word like this. And it is allocentric versus egocentric. Allocentric is a term that people who study spaces use. And it refers to understanding where you are in a space, not from your own point of view, but from a kind of elevated point of view, so that you can see how, say, this block is related to that street, is related to that river, all from a point of view that's sort of above, let's just say. Whereas an egocentric point of view, which sounds nasty, it's really not meant to be, just means that you know a space based on where you are within it. Like, oh, to the left is the store and to the right is the river. Of where I'm standing. Mm-hmm. So this is a kind of long way of saying that coming up with that term allocentric really helped me understand something that I had had to work out on my own in writing the memoir and speaking as a woman in her, whatever I was, late 40s, early 50s, thinking about my life. But from this position, that meant I was no longer sort of in the thick of it. I wasn't kind of in the forest. I was able to be above the forest and look down at it. So that's a sort of quick way to get to the idea of perceiving pattern after the fact. And then in the case of writing fiction, I don't know how, well, I do know because I teach a lot of writers, but I think it's very easy to be in the middle of what you're writing. You're in that river, you're in that forest, you're kind of, you know, staggering along, slashing through things, trying to figure out what you're saying and what you mean. And when you've gotten to the end, you can see, oh, okay, this is sort of what I wanted to do. Now I go back and start again, but I can now sort of look at the whole thing almost as if I'm overhead looking at a garden, looking at something like that really is visual, and see how I can most clearly organize the sort of passage I want a reader to make through what I've written, whether I want them to be moving excitedly forward towards some great climax as with the dramatic arc, or if I actually want something else because the story is of a different nature.
Right. And it's worth noting, when you started the memoir, I think you at first attempted that as a piece of fiction and then realized it was not going to work that way.
Oh, yeah, that is true. And in fact, it was the first thing I tried writing at all after having other quasi careers as an illustrator and editor. And I know I started writing short stories, and then the short stories were autobiographical. And then I thought, oh, maybe they're connected, as one does. There's always that phase when you think, oh, I'm going to have linked stories. Because you haven't figured out yet how you want the whole thing to come together. And that's when I went to grad school to Columbia, and I did turn it into a novel. But because the memoir is about my life, and in particular, something that my parents did, which was two couples met each other and traded partners. So I grew up in this very strange, absolutely symmetrical family with two parents on either side, two sets of daughters on either side, the same ages. It was sort of like this butterfly. It was too much. It didn't work in fiction. It was just too tidy. And all of the parallels and things that happened were just too clean. And so it was a failure as a novel. And it took me quite a few years to turn it into a memoir. And then I had the beauty and the horror of actual truth to write, rather than trying to blunt all the edges and make it feel convincing by making it less true in a weird way that fiction sometimes does.
Right. Well, I just brought that up because I think, you know, perhaps your life being so patterned, this mirror imaging that you grew up with, got your brain subconsciously thinking about patterns in nature, patterns in fiction. And I was just wondering if some of that life experience informed how you think about narrative when you think about your own narrative story structure. It's kind of built into who you are, kind of built into your experiential DNA. So I was just curious about that. And it sounds like just the act and exercise of grappling with how to tell that story, whether it's fiction, whether it's memoir, all those obvious patterns that, you know, naturally played out in the story itself. It feels like all of that was kind of momentum that led to the book we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it was something like that. I think it took me a long time to realize that having a perfectly symmetrical family was not what everyone had. I was probably about 7 when I realized that telling the story of my family was interesting, and that other people did not have, you know, a stepsister with the same birthday, you know, who lived on the opposite side of the world. So I think that the idea of pattern was really, really formative. So formative, it was probably a little bit deformative. And also there's something about living, I was in the Foreign Service as a kid, living in the Foreign Service, where sometimes the closest relationships you end up having are with the place, because I don't know, it's horrible to say, but the people become interchangeable. And so I spent a lot of time looking at nature, looking at plants and at rocks and at the sky. I mean, the sky was the thing that did not really change. So I would have my communications with stars and look for patterns up there. So yeah, I think upbringing in the Foreign Service and this particular family put pattern thinking deeply in me.
So it probably makes sense if the listeners are new to writing to just introduce the origin of the arc and talk about kind of the classic structure that we all know. So we know what we're pushing up against as we talk about the rest of the book. So can you just kind of briefly introduce the notion and origins of the narrative arc just to set the foundation for us?
Yes, this will be lightning fast. I would say that the arc came to fiction by way of drama, even though fiction is a different form. It's on the page, it's narrative. There's often a narrator. It's not watching a drama. And it is Aristotle who first formulated, at least in Western culture, what made a good drama. And he did it in a really interesting inductive way, not deductive way. He examined successful tragedies. He examined Sophocles. He examined Aeschylus. And he looked at how these things had been formed. And from these specimens, because he was a scientist, he sorted out certain principles that there would be a situation and a character in some sort of conflict. And the conflict would get more and more steep until finally some sort of explosion and recognition happened. And then things would settle down. And that really is the arc as he saw it in drama. And Gustav Freytag, almost 2,000 years later, a German scholar of drama, pretty much followed the same principles of Aristotle and gave us the drawing. So the famous Freytag's triangle that so many of us have seen in 1,000 different versions, which has, you know, introduction and conflict building and climax and resolution, etc. And it's true that a lot of narrative, a lot of fiction has a natural dramatic feel to it. And, you know, we've borrowed from it in fiction for good reasons. And there are trillions of excellent pieces of writing that do follow this pattern. But I first became aware of it as sort of the thing that was foisted upon us as writers in reading John Gardner way back when, The Art of Fiction, where he says that really the kind of simplest and best way to approach a fiction is to follow that triangle. And he says, Aristotle, of course, was talking about drama, but if he'd known about fiction, he would have said the same thing about fiction, which I bought at the time 20 or so years ago. But then I thought, I don't think so. I think Aristotle was a scientist and he would actually look at specimens of fiction and say, oh, what's going on here? How are these things made? Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, how we get the arc. It's nice when you're a teacher to have something straightforward to teach. And, you know, what could be better than, you know, showing young people this triangle and saying, here, do this. And like I said, I mean, my first novel followed it and other works I've used have followed it, but other works I've written have followed it. But it is, you know, it is a form and it can be wonderfully successful, but it isn't the form that was most interesting to me when I started writing my second and third books and found myself more and more interested in narratives that were unusual, that were maybe more experimental, or that in any case were developing all of their energies and all of their interest in some way other than following a drama. So that's when I first started thinking about what was it in these other things I was reading that made them work? And it took quite a long time and reading a lot and teaching for years and writing more before I started to develop the ideas that I come up with in this book.
It's interesting because you point out that there's a masculosexual nature to the arc. And I only bring that up because I think that's right. And you know, you talk about this as kind of how men experience a sexual act, not necessarily how women experience a sexual act. And then I was wondering if this whole construct was sort of foisted upon us by men mostly. And then I started thinking about all of the very interesting and experiential ways that women have structured fiction. Most recently, Jerome Lampieri's Whereabouts novel. I mean, there's so many examples recently, and I haven't thought about this deeply enough to unpack it. And so I thought I'd ask you if you have thought a little bit more about whether there is a male versus female approach to storytelling, where you think there is something about this masculine arc, if that holds true in fiction, or am I just putting too much on that?
No, I say a few things about that in the book, and I would like to think that, but then you probably have to separate what might be a masculine way of writing from actual men doing the writing, and the same thing, feminine from actual women doing the writing, because plenty of women follow the arc and plenty of men do not. And It was actually a white male writer, a German white male writer, whose work first got me thinking about this really, really more deeply. But just to, before getting into that, yeah, I do think, though, on the idea of women having a different style of writing, one of my favorite examples of someone who really is perhaps doing a version of, and I cannot pronounce French, but it is the term écriture féminine. Someone else can pronounce that better, I hope. But Marie Redonnet, her novel Hotel Splendide, I think is a fantastic example of what seems to be a sort of feminine writing about feminine experience, in this case, in a very comical and dark way. And it's because instead of having a sort of single dramatic arc, there is nothing like an arc in it. Instead, there's a trillion little teeny tiny little arclets or little wavelets where she's trying to clean something in the hotel and something else breaks and she tries to fix it and then something else breaks and then she, and it goes on and on and on like that. So in a way, it replicates something a little bit closer to female orgasmic experience, if we want to go back to that, meaning lots of little things and not maybe the one big one that the boys apparently get.
Yeah, I started thinking about this with, I was talking to Jess Walter about his Cold Millions book, and he was one of the kind of first people to open my eyes to, when I'm writing a book, I think of it in a very visual way. And that book he structured as a river, but he said all of his novels are done in some visual way, that there is some pattern in nature that he tries to emulate. I think that book was really very narrative arc-ish, but nonetheless, he tries to graft onto it some sort of thing in nature to give him sort of a guide once he figures out the structure of the story. So yeah, I think it's really interesting to step back from work and look at it as patterns in nature. I know that The Emigrants was one of the first books that kind of opened your eyes to this. So maybe you can introduce us to that book and how that book started to change your thinking about this.
Sure. So W.G. Zabald's book, The Emigrants, which I read, I think, first in the mid-90s, when I was living in Germany, actually, and trying to learn German. And so I was reading hard German books to try and get it done. But it's a book that is written in four separate sections. He calls them Erzählungen, which means more or less recountings or narrations. There are four different sections, the same narrator. And in each of these sections, the narrator encounters or re-encounters or thinks hard about a man that he once knew. And in three of the cases, this person has committed suicide. And so what's all that really goes on is that the narrator is with the man or thinking about the man or visits the man and starts going back into his life and starts trying to see how he lived or what happened or why he killed himself or, you know, and they move in different directions. But there are these four narratives and they are not really connected in any linear or chronological way. You've got the same narrator and similar thematic material and similar sorts of circumstances and a similar world because it's all Europe. But there's no, you could never ever graft on this any sort of single barreled narrative that's beginning somewhere and ending somewhere else. And instead, what I found reading it was that I was following certain images that recur in each of the four narratives, and they were beginning to quietly, I don't know, string together a larger idea about what this book was doing. Something that was more exciting, really, than any kind of dramatic action I could imagine. And I won't go into the details of it, but it involves Lolita and butterflies and someone called the Butterfly Man. So Nabokov is throughout the whole book. But the main action then was in my head, really, where I'm reading this thing very carefully. I'm seeing this recurring image, recurring phrases, certain things that are interacting in a sort of subterranean level. And I was beginning to develop ideas about what they were doing in this book and why, how they're all coming together. And by the time I got to the end, I felt put together something that to me was incredibly exciting about what the enterprise of the book was and how these four narratives were a vehicle to do something much larger. So that got me thinking about different ways that narratives could have a lot of energy and a lot of excitement beyond the dramatic action. And it took quite a lot of work after that. I was living in Germany and I was not allowed to work in Germany. I was married then and my husband worked there. And so anyway, another story, but I had a lot of time to read is the point here and a lot of time to write. So I did write books and I did a lot of research, but I started looking into something called spatial fiction. And that is a sort of way of looking at fiction that acquires its energies in a way more like poetry. So through association and through close conjunction of different images rather than action and drama. And I realized that this book was a spatial sort of book, because it was something that I was sort of looking at, and there were lines going from the book to me and from the book to me, and I was drawing lines across the four sections. And that was a kind of pattern it had that had nothing to do with dramatic arc, but that still was really satisfying and could create a sense of completion and order. So that book, then various other books I read, like Marguerite Duras, The Lover, and a whole host of others that seemed to be operating on a different level, started making me think, and it took quite some years to realize that there were different ways that you could structure a narrative. There could be different sorts of patterns other than the wave. And the arc. And when I translate the arc into natural form, I think of a wave, you know, with this kind of rising, accelerating energy and then crash down. And I realized that among the many things I had been reading that seemed to have different patterns at their core, I didn't have a word for the patterns. I would think, oh, this feels like an elevator, or this feels like a labyrinth, or this feels like a tree. And it was only when I began reading more about natural patterns that I suddenly discovered, and I don't believe in epiphany in fiction, but I sure had one in life. And that was that the various texts I'd been reading, and I'd been giving them these funny names like labyrinth and river and so on, they happen to correspond to what various natural scientists have called nature's darlings, and patterns that recur in nature across all scales. And so this is where the book started to organize itself, was when I realized that these patterns that I've been finding in narrative had corollaries in the natural world.
I love talking to artists across other mediums, you know, photographers, visual artists, and so many of these conversations are relevant across art. And I think this is one of the biggest ones. You know, it's just pleasurable to the brain to have subtle patterns in architecture, obviously, and visual arts, and to see that mirrored in writing, I think is incredibly exciting, probably what got Sarah so excited about this book as well. And it also strikes me that your study of Greek and Latin and German would necessarily cause you to slow way down and study things, you know, not even at the sentence level, but at the word level and at the letter level. And that sort of intensive study of our language, how it looks on the page, how it feels in your mouth, other languages where you have to construct the word in a different way inside your mouth, hear it in a different way inside your head, seems like it would make you so attentive to language as to change the way you think about language, and then maybe change the way you construct things on a bigger level, on the sentence level, on the paragraph and story level. I don't know how you feel about these other languages informing how you think about writing in English.
That's a really interesting point that I thought about a little bit, but in the case of Latin and Greek, and really way more Latin than Greek, Greek is hard. I really had hard. Latin I started in junior high school and carried on with throughout a bit of graduate school. And it is a dead language, which is a sad thing, but also a beautiful thing, because you can have just this wonderful silent relationship with it. And it's a visual relationship. And reading poems, reading Horace, reading Ovid, reading Virgil, reading Catullus, reading many of those guys, and Sulpicia, one woman writer from those days, you'd be looking at the page, and the words themselves in Latin, they can appear in pretty much any order in a sentence. And so the beauty of Latin, I haven't had the pleasure of talking about Latin in a while, so bear with me. But the beauty, I thought the beauty of Latin was that it was really like a puzzle. So there weren't articles, there weren't the kinds of things that we have in English and in German that give you a certain word order. You have to just know what the endings of the words signify and then rearrange the whole thing into sense in your own language when you read. So it's like a puzzle. So that is a sort of visual relationship to language more than an auditory one. And honestly, we never read Latin aloud. So I don't have an auditory relationship with it. But also looking at poems on the page, Latin poems and Greek poems on the page, there's so much white space. And the white space is it is pleasurable, I think. It gives more room to think, and your eye can roam around a little bit, and it's less pressuring than, say, going back to Sebald, the kind of terrifying long solid blocks of paragraphs that he has that go on for pages and pages. I think that reading really slowly, because I have to read German slowly, had to read Latin slowly, had to really read Greek slowly. And so it is more a kind of temporal and visual relationship with language that made me think of writing as something that has texture. texture being one of the visual elements that we can play with, I think. Because like I just said about the Sebald, when you're faced with a page that has no indents whatsoever and no line breaks, it's a very different experience from looking at something that is floating in the middle with lots of white space around it. You know, they both have their beauties and they both have their effects on the reader, but it's the kind of thing writers can also play with in terms of thinking of writing as something that is visual, not only in the sense of the large pattern you have at the end of the whole thing, whether it's an arc or a spiral or some other shape, and not only in terms of what you're conveying through the words, what you want a reader to see with your words, but just letting a reader experience the page itself in a certain way. You know, this is going to be this wonderful airy experience, or no, this is dense, I better, you know, put my glasses on and get ready.
Right. Especially German. I know nothing about German except trying to drive on German streets. There's no white space even on their street signs because the words are so very, they're so very long. Yeah. And it is a very different experience. I mean, there's an intimidation factor, I think, when you just see blocks of text and really long, hard words. It doesn't give the eye the room to sort of play and wander and explore. You're right. You have to put on your glasses and say, we're going to concentrate now. The other point you make in the book, very quick and subtle, but I think it's interesting, is that Chinese fiction, so I'm thinking of Eastern fiction now, emphasized lyricism and didn't rely on the arc. So I was also wondering if, you know, if this arc construction was a very Western idea and if there's a little bit more play and maybe there's an Eastern conception of storytelling that is very different than what we are locked into in the Western mind, aligning that with the masculine mind.
This is something I would actually like to know a lot more about. And I could only put in the book a few little stray sentences because I was just beginning to learn something then and I still have not gotten more. So I would welcome reader input on this. But what I did understand was that a lot of Chinese literature and East Asian literature did seem to come out of different traditions that were more linked to poetry and more linked to lyricism and imagery and the associations among images rather than the sort of causality and sequentiality that we acquired starting really with Aristotle.
My guest this morning is Jane Allison. The book we are talking about is Meander, Spiral, Explode, Design and Pattern in Narrative. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I would love to start breaking down some of the sections of the book because I think that there's so many useful things. I wanted to start with the section, the study of time, movement, and flow in the primary elements section of the book, because we've talked a lot about Bullet in the Brain on the show over the years, using it as an example of different things in fiction. But here, the study of time and movement and taking us out of the linear structure, the story is such a wonderful example of that. And it's just one of my all-time favorite stories. So I thought we could begin there, how that story is such a great example of not using the dramatic arc to such wonderful effect.
That is such an excellent story. And I end up teaching it every single year. And now it's becoming sort of a commonplace in the undergraduate program that, oh, it's time for Bullet in the Brain again, because apparently we all teach it at one point or other, but in different ways. But it is such a good story. And it's so pleasurable to read. I think a lot of people teach it for character because you learn so much about Anders' character by the end that you would never have expected at the beginning. And it is great for that. But I love to teach it and read it for how he handles pretty much every speed of time that we have in narrative. So this is not original thinking by me. Narratologists have sorted out different speeds and there's a certain conventional way of understanding them that, do you want me to go over the speeds or is that too?
Sure, yeah, do that.
So let's see. So a kind of baseline way of having time in narrative is when the time that you spend reading the thing is about the same as the time that the thing takes place. So the narrative world has action in it and it takes 7 minutes and it takes you 7 minutes to read it. So then you have a kind of one-to-one relationship between narrative world, story time, and reader time. And that's, you know, scene, basically. You're writing scenes and people are speaking and things are happening. But you can go faster than that by summary, where you just will suddenly say in one sentence something that took 5 years to happen. And you can go even faster than that by having a gap where there's absolutely no story. It takes no time to read something, but you understand that 15 years have passed. And you can go more slowly. You can have what's called a dilation, where in the middle of a scene, say, something will suddenly get very, very, very spelled out. And so you know that it's taking you longer to read it than is actually happening in the narrative world. And you can stop everything. You can just plain have a pause. And the narrator might say, well, reader, let me tell you now about something that happened, you know, 10 years earlier. So there are different ways that you can manipulate time. And to be a writer, you have to know them, I think, because you want to, I believe you want to have a, you know, as richly textured a narrative as you can. And pacing is really important. And the longer the work, the more important it is really to have a variety of speeds. This is sounding awfully prescriptive, and I'm sure there are exceptions, but this is just a quick way of putting it.
Yeah.
And in Bullet in the Brain, I think he uses in a very short space all of those main speeds. You begin with scene, and then there's a fabulous moment when Anders, the gunmen have come into the bank, and Anders is looking up at the ceiling. And it's this weird, ridiculous moment when he's being an art critic, looking at the ceiling as he could be shot at any moment. And that's this weird dilation, and it sort of sets a reader up for something else to happen. It's this kind of weird slowing down. And then sure enough, in the next moment, something does happen. And this is a spoiler alert, but he is shot in the head. And then everything slows down even more when we go through this whole listing of things that Anders does not remember in the micro, nanosecond between the bullet being shot and him dying. And so it's a pause where, in fact, nothing is going on in the story world, but we are told all the things that he does not remember. And then finally we get to the thing that he does remember. And so that's back in actual time, but it's once again so slowed down. Anyway, I could go on and on about it, but in terms of how he varies, how Tobias Wolff varies the time treatment in the story, it makes it incredibly dynamic and very surprising. But he does something else in terms of not quite time treatment, but plotting. And that is that instead of having the story run in the kind of classic linear order where you begin with Anders as a boy and you have all these things that happen, and then here it is, he's in his 50s and he's in the bank and he gets shot, which would make for a very poor, boring story. You start near the end and then back up and then have all of these things spliced in there. And so it's not original. People do that all the time. It's a kind of in medias res in an extreme way, but he has plotted the story very differently from the way the timeline would go. So that story is such a great example of really important things to do in narrative, treating time and deciding how you're going to plot the incidents, whether you're going to have them run in a linear way or go use some different order for effect.
If you were going to put that story into one of the subsequent eight patterns, is there an obvious one that it would fit into?
Let's see. That's a good question.
I mean, I was trying to do that myself, and I could put in a couple of different ones, but...
Which ones, let's throw it back to you. Which ones did you decide?
Well, I mean, in certain ways, it was kind of wavelets, right? Because he just took several passes at these are what his memories were not. These are what his memories were. We just kept backing up and moving forward. But then I was like, well, that's kind of meandery too. That's kind of, I'm not as good at this and I'm not as visual. So I'm like, okay, I was really trying to do it, but I wasn't sure if I was doing it right.
Well, I think that one thing that I feel I've actually had to say quite a few times since this book came out 2 years ago is that not all stories fit into these patterns. Many stories are in totally different patterns that aren't things I've come up with. So, and many stories are arcs. So it's not as though one of these natural patterns is lurking within all stories. I don't think that's the case. There are many other ways to construct a story. And I honestly don't know that I see a natural pattern in this one.
Okay.
In a way, you know, it's not so unarchy because it does move. I mean, technically there is this dramatic action that begins, you know, in a present when he goes into the bank and ends at the end when finally the bullet has killed him. So yeah. You do sort of stay in the present in that way with this great big, you know, pause or dilation, you know, midway through. So in a way it kind of has its climactic end. So
yeah.
I don't know. I think I would probably align it more with Arcland than not.
But the interesting thing about it is that the dramatic moment you would think is him getting shot. I suppose it is, but it's almost beside the point, right? I mean, we know that before, based on the title of the story, we sort of suspect that's what's going to happen. So that's not the interesting part of the story. So yeah, it's fun to put things that we've read for years and years up against this and try and unpack it in a different way. It just makes you think about the story in a new way.
But you know what, actually, as you say that, yes. So the main thing that happens in the story that is the sort of revelation, if you want to use a term like that, isn't that he gets shot, because as you say, guess what? It's in the title. I think this is another way to look at the arc also that I like, which is you can have that kind of dramatic action and peak of excitement happen within the reader before it sort of drops off again. And I think that's another way to think about constructing a story that might have arciness in it is how you can have that effect within a reader so that they have this sort of tightening engagement, and then all of a sudden, bang, and then it sort of drops again. Because in that story for me, you know, yes, he's shot in the head, and that could be in terms of the dramatic action, that could be the peak, but it's not very interesting because I don't give a damn about Anders yet. It's only after he's been shot in the head that we get all of this kind of cascade of bits of pieces of his life that I start to care about him. So that by the end, my relationship to him has completely transformed. And I think, man, this is terrible. He was a boy that you know, loved language, and then things just went wrong.
Exactly right. I think that is the dramatic arc for me, is I started out not liking him at all, and I ended up really loving him and was sad. So yeah, the revelation is really who he is, not what happened to him. Right? How we came to understand him versus how we came to understand what happened to him.
Yeah.
Actually, that's a good place to ask one of Sarah's questions, which is, given that the book with the kinds of shapes you write about take more work on the reader's part, what have you observed how a writer can make that work appealing to a reader or invite the reader into the work, which I think we were kind of getting at a little bit here with Bullet in the Brain.
Oh, okay. So if I'm understanding the question, if these other patterns might take more work, how do you get a reader to enjoy, to get engaged?
Exactly. Kind of, can you teach readers to read books with diverse structure through the writing itself? Can you kind of retrain readers? I think she's asking, can you kind of retrain readers out of the classic narrative arc that they're used to into something else?
I think so. I think, I mean, the example that popped into my head right away, because you're trying, I mean, I don't know, I guess I think that the kinds of books I read and the ones I try to write, they do want a reader to work. They want a reader, it's like, it's a very intense communication I'm trying to have with the writer or with the text when I'm reading. And, you know, conversely with the reader, the invisible reader, when I'm writing, I want there to be a little struggle, honestly, but I want the struggle to be worth it. You know, like that experience I had reading The Zabald, reading The Emigrants, where I would just kept thinking, what is pulling me forward? What is pulling me forward? Because it's not story really or drama. It's me trying to understand certain things. You know, so that was a book where I had to be taught by Zabald how to read it. And that was to be alert to different things. In this case, this recurrent image of the butterfly man. But I'm thinking the example that popped into my head was Jimmy Kincaid's Mr. Potter, which is a book many people do not like and many people do like. And she starts to teach you how to read it in the very beginning with this insane amount of repetition, where she says, you know, in the first page, you know, in that day, the sun was in the sky, way up high and in the middle of the sky. And she repeats that phrase, I don't know, 15 times in the first two pages.
Mm-hmm.
And so any reader, I mean, any reader who's going to keep reading is already thinking, all right, what's she doing here? Why am I getting this kind of repetition? Why am I getting this obsessive repetition of certain details that seem to me mundane? So, you know, you have to start looking carefully. So I think any text that is trying to do something and really is cares and has urgency about something that is beyond kind of, you know, entertainment or drama in its own right, needs to be working with the reader and sort of teaching how to be read as it goes by doing things that are slightly unexpected. Like Nicholson Baker's The Mezzanine, you get a footnote on the first page. And you think, okay, and then, you know, by the middle of the book, the footnotes are almost the entire page. So anyone who dreads the footnote, you know, you've been sort of walked into this thing and learning that footnotes are where a lot of stuff goes on and you need to pay attention to those things. So, you know, you establish your own patterns and systems of interest and energy and hope, I guess, that the reader will pay attention and will follow them and will become as seduced as you want them to be.
I wonder if to that point, you need to start doing that very early on in a story. Again, not to be too prescriptive about how to do things, because there's a million ways to do things. But as part of, you know, like in sci-fi, you would start your world building very early on so that the reader understands the rules of how things work. And I wonder if in structuring, if you're going to structure something really very different, as you say, Baker introduces that footnote on page one, Kincaid starts to train you in the first couple of paragraphs to say, this is something different. You're going to have to pay attention in a different way. And I'm going to lead you on a different kind of journey than maybe you're used to. But I know there's 1,000 ways to do things.
Yeah, I think you do need to. I mean, I don't know. I'm always going to sound prescriptive whenever I say you need to or you should do. But I think that a text naturally starts to do it if it is true to itself. It's like that's the kind of organism it is. So it's sort of introducing itself right at the beginning. Some of the other examples I have in the book, and just those are the ones that are closest to my head at the moment. For instance, Susan Minot's story, Lust, where you realize that, okay, I'm going to be reading a little teeny paragraph and then there's white space, then another teeny paragraph, which is the same narrator, but you know, different situation. Oh, she seems to be creating a catalog. Okay, this is a catalog of boys the narrator's been with. So why is she doing this? What's going to happen? How will there be anything that moves forward? How will anything, you know, change? But because she's already sort of showing you these are my spots, these are my stripes, then you know, you sort of have to begin to realize, okay, I'm reading something with spots and stripes.
And when does this sort of, as you are working through it yourself, I don't know if you talked to any of these writers about how they did it or thought about it as they were doing it, but at least how you are thinking about it now in your own work, at what point in the work does the structure present itself? Do you go into it saying, I'm going to write a meandering novel, I'm going to write a spiral novel, or do you write for 500 pages and then say, this is a meandering novel?
I'm laughing right now because we haven't done that. I think that, and this is how I teach also, I think that anyone who goes into a text knowing what the structure is frightens me. And I'm sure that you can do it, but when I have students who you know, are super smart and they have all of these visions and so much they want to write, it's when, you know, you start something conceptual or schematic, you're going to get trapped. I think you're going to get caught. And it's as bad as being caught in the arc if you get caught in an arc. So I know that it only works for me when I have written and written and written and the thing starts to emerge. I know that my novels that I have written, I mean, one of them really does follow an arc, and I think it needed to follow an arc, and the arc is just fine. And another one is really wavelets, because I realized I'm interested in all these different things and all these different people and these little dramas that are happening and overlapping and kind of splashing into each other. And one of them is what I call a cellular novel, a more modular one. I was really inspired by The Emigrants and wrote something not even remotely as good, but it's in these sections that are really discrete, but you know, you can find commonalities. I think that in each case, the thing itself, the story, for lack of a better term, who the figures were, what the preoccupations were, what the sort of language was, those all came first. And probably each one of those things had to be written, I don't know how many times, once I realized what I thought the structure needed to be.
So when you are writing towards a narrative arc, the inclination is to ask yourself as writer, what happens next? What happens next? What happens next? And it strikes me, if you are writing in a different structure, the question would be different. You know, you wouldn't ask what happens next because it's not really relevant. And so I was wondering, in these 8 patterns that you lay out, are there questions the writer should be asking herself that are different than the classic, what happens next?
Well, one other question is, why did this happen? And yeah, it's really a very, very ancient kind of narrative that could end up being archy, but doesn't have to be. And that is a mystery. I mean, Oedipus Rex, Oedipus the King, is one of the most, is the first example I can think of where you begin at the end with a puzzle and you're trying to figure out, how did this happen? How did we get here? I mean, there's a mystery here to be solved. So that's a very fundamentally different kind of question from, say, the adventure story of you know, what happens next? What happens next? It's, you know, how did this happen? And a lot of writing in the last 100 years has been more of the, how did this get this way? And I sometimes call it the exfoliatory novel, beginning with Freud, honestly, where we have a character and we're trying to understand why they're so screwed up. You know, here's a person exhibiting all of this, whatever, and then the whole story kind of winds back into the trauma that caused it, et cetera, which is its own kind of formula. So what happens next is one. How did this happen is another. And I guess other questions are, it's hard, it's sort of hard to talk into the ocean like this.
Right. I know.
I'm just trying to think of other questions. It's really, I'm really interested at the moment in memory and in the ways that patterns simply happen in terms of how you remember something and reconstruct something, or honestly construct something out of memory. So I think a lot about images, you know, how are these images relating to each other when they bump up against each other? How is one image speaking back to something that is a similar sort of image, but maybe 15 pages earlier or later. So I think questioning, you know, what the images are doing and what the content of the images is, why these things seem to need to be part of the same narrative.
You make that point really nicely in the color section of the book. You always say that you're such a counter, and you meticulously counted, I think, the number of times the color red was used in a certain text. But I think that is a nice way, these images, what they mean, how they're juxtaposed against each other. And they're not always symbolic. Your point about color, you can read it as a symbol, or you can read it in other ways. You know, it can be serving the story. Color can be serving a story. Objects, images can be serving a story, not just metaphorically or symbolically, but in other ways. And I think that's something writers should really keep their eye on. Repetition of words, recurring images, how images are put up against each other. I guess that also comes up in the wavelet section when things keep repeating and recurring.
But going back to color for a minute, because I'm thinking about that at the moment with something I'm writing, I suddenly thought, oh, color, I need to remember that I can be playing with color, and I need to be playing with color, because I wish someone else would write more about color in narrative and the effects that color can have, and not exactly what you were saying, not color as symbol, not color, you know, standing for something, you know, green as hope or whatever, but the color effect that a whole text can have, and how that's a thing that you can manipulate, or you can see happening as you draft, and then you can begin to think more consciously about, because it, you know, it can leave an after effect in the reader's mind that has a lot, you know, almost as much to do with what stays as, say, the plot does. I mean, I know when I think back on certain books, I do have a sense of color.
Yeah,
I think of Mary Robeson's Why Did I Ever, and I just get all of this kind of bright pop confetti color in my head. And Sebald was the example I studied first, because everything is sort of sepia and gray, and he doesn't use the words, but it's just, that is the sense that you're going to have. And I have heard the same words from everyone I've ever asked about that book. And the one you were mentioning, it was once again Tobias Wolff. It was his books, The Barracks Thief, his book, The Barracks Thief,
right.
I really did obsessively and probably miscounted, I fear, after not by much, only by a couple of words. But he uses very, very, very few color words. But when he does, it was invariably, the one that kept coming up the most was red and oranges. And so these kind of hot colors, these inflammatory colors. And when you read The Barracks Thief, you understand why that will become relevant. But it just made me think, oh my God, there's this whole other level we can work with and we can include when we are, you know, designing this whole experience, which is a narrative. It's not just how you want a reader to move through it, whether they're kind of racing forward or whether they're idling and eddying and going a little bit backwards, or whether they're, you know, exploding out of some central trauma or whatever. You know, you can control or try to control the texture that a reader feels when they are looking at the page, because that, you know, like we talked about that, the sort of the psychological effect of airiness or dense blocks. But on a subtle level, there's also the coloration of the whole thing. That can be a kind of, I don't know, subliminal way of communicating just as much as the words themselves are and the image patterns.
This made me sort of think about writer as cinematographer and how you can, yes, create such a visual landscape for the reader. I mean, the beauty of fiction and novels is that you get all this great interiority that you can't do in film or television, but the novel allows you all of that. But there are ways that the novelist, for the things that novels lack, you can get in there. You can create this sepia tone over everything, this grayness or this pop of color. And that sort of got me thinking about whether film is able to take advantage of these different narrative structures, because film and TV seem so dramatic, arc-driven. And there's obviously experimental films out there that perhaps take advantage of these different patterns and ways of storytelling. But it just got me thinking, you know, if this is something that is best applied to fiction, or if there's a way to translate it into other mediums.
Yeah, I'm actually going to be giving a talk about the book to narrative filmmakers in, not actually going to Portugal, I'm going to be Zooming, but still, I'm interested to hear what people there have to say about the use of pattern, because narrative is still going to be narrative even when it's a different medium. And I suspect that there's even more use of this kind of patterning in film than there is in literature. I don't know. I'm going to find out. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll have to reconvene and talk about that. That's really interesting. So tell me a little bit about how you came up with these 8 patterns and how you found, did the patterns emerge from the texts that you chose, or did you see the patterns and try to find the texts to graft onto those?
The patterns emerged from the texts themselves. And so I started with the disabled, with the emigrants. And so there were these blocks. And yet I knew I was kind of drawing nets between the blocks, like different words that recurred in different images. So I was sort of creating this whole network of sense among the different blocks. And the same kind of thing happened when I read Susan Minot's Lust, where you have these little pieces and you have to figure out, well, how is the whole thing moving forward? And it's because, oh, I'm thinking certain things, I'm making connections and I'm making assumptions and associations. In that case, I thought, okay, these are narratives that work in pieces and something else is going on that gives it movement. And I didn't quite have the language for it yet. And then reading other texts, like I think it was the Mezzanine, where the famous story, it's all about one ride up an escalator at a lunch break, and yet it goes on for quite a while, and there are all these footnotes. And so I realized there's something going on here where we are moving forward, but oh my God, so slowly, because we keep having to go take a little sidetrack and go back over here and look at this and do this. So I knew that was, and I had it as in my mind, a kind of escalator shape, which was completely unsatisfying. I won't go through all the examples, but it's okay. One more example where, for instance, Chronicle of a Death Foretold, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, where you already know in the beginning that the guy is going to be killed. And it's already happened really in the first paragraph, but then the book advances and advances with different angles on the killing from different people in this village, in this town. And so in time, we only move forward an hour or something like that, but we get all these different views from all these different angles, and it felt kind of kaleidoscopic to me. So I had read things like this and more, and I had little images I would make, little drawings I would make of them. And I had my not very satisfactory names like kaleidoscope or pinwheel or escalator or escalator, yeah. And then when I thought I need to learn more about actual patterns and, you know, what is patterning and what does it mean? And I was reading this book called Patterns in Nature. And I just couldn't believe my eyes when the man who wrote it, a scientist of many fields, I don't even know quite properly which single field he would be identified with, began speaking, and this was in the 70s, that he wrote this book of these recurrent patterns in nature and how they occur at different levels, like a spiral, can be as microscopic as our DNA or as huge as a hurricane. But there are certain principles in the physical world, you know, gravity and fluid dynamics and all sorts of things, geometry, that make certain things happen again and again. And a spiral is one, and a meander is one. So something that flows forward, but, you know, will kind of curl around and go back, but it does keep going. An explosive or radial shape is one, like a daisy, like an explosion, like a star, where the center of energy seems to be in the middle, and then everything spokes out or radiates out from it. And fractals, another one, which are all over the place. So how a tree branches, how roots branch. So I realized that my shapes, you know, like pinwheel was really an explosion, or this kind of escalator thing that kept being too slow was really a meander. Or the modular thing that I had seen in Sebald and in Susan Minot was really cellular. So I realized these are shapes in nature. These are patterns that recur for all kinds of good, solid scientific reasons that artists have used for centuries and millennia again and again. And I seem to be finding the same things in these stories. There's something that gives these narratives a sense of cogency and form. They're not just sort of formless things, but it's not the one we're used to. It's something else that still seems to find something in the brain, my brain anyway, that makes it feel like it is a formed patterned thing.
Going back to your point about mezzanine, I should learn my lesson because I've asked this of many people and the result is dead air. And so I think the answer is there is not an answer. But is there a word or a literary device to describe this notion of how a story is patterned, that it mirrors, the form of the story mirrors the content of the story, like the escalator? Because I'm thinking of like the word onomatopoeia, where you've got, you know, bam is a word to simulate the noise you're trying to describe. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if there should be a word, we should invent a word for the kind of the literary device of when the form of the book is mirroring the content of the book. And I was kind of thinking about this with Saramago's Blindness, where he doesn't use any quotation marks. And so the reader has the experience of being blind because we don't know who's talking. We don't know where the words are coming from. So we're kind of, you know, blindly bumping through the book, kind of not understanding
who people are and where they are. I just love that. I just love and Baker's mezzanine when the form of the narrative mimics the content he's trying to convey. I just think it's brilliant.
I wish I had a word for you. I've got a word that's close. I don't think it's going to do the job, but I think mirror in the text is
a nice one.
It's not really right. But it might help. Find one where there's something in the text that is a sort of miniature of the whole thing, or when, you know, what it sort of stands for, what the whole thing is doing. It's not
what I'm
talking about, but it's also cool.
I love it. Yeah. I just think there should be a word for that because I see it in, especially in poetry, you know, in poetry, you could have like a poem that's the shape of a snake on the page. If you look at it and, you know, it's a poem about snakes. I mean, that's a terrible example, but something where, you know, where form is imitating content.
I bet you there's a word. Someone's going to call in.
Shouldn't there be? Yes. Oh, Jane, this was so fun. I know that you now have gone back, or I heard you had gone back at least a couple of years ago to work on, at the very beginning of Meander, there is this image of this house that's being constructed, an architectural house that's being constructed. And I heard that you are trying to go back and unpack that as a novel. Is that still the case?
Yes, it is.
Good.
Doing that just this morning. No, it's a novel that I actually drafted completely 10 years ago and just hated. I just hated it. But it's based on a real story about Corbusier and Eileen Gray, which has become rather famous in the 10 years I have screwed around because she's an important architect and she's getting a lot of attention. But anyway, it is a novel that is based on something that happened between the two of them in a house she designed that became a point of obsession for him. And it's all an architectural heritage site now. But anyway, yes, so I have returned to that. I'm planning to be done with it in about 2 weeks because I can't take it any longer.
Fantastic. Did this book help or perhaps it hurt? Did this book help or hurt when you were trying to construct narrative?
Well, actually, I thought now that I've written Meander Spiral, I need to pay attention and see if the next thing I write is going to, you know, I just have to be alert. And I think that having already written it several times, I did have those 500 pages or more that you were talking about at the top of the hour. So it is a good time to look back and be more deliberate about how the thing is shaped now that I have really all the material. So yes, there's going to be a pattern with this one that I'm trying to work with a little bit more consciously because it is, I think, the natural pattern that the story would have and does have being, anyway, I won't go into it, but it's from the point of view of two older people both remembering certain incidents. And so I think when you're working with memory, there's often a kind of spiraling that goes on, you know, where you're in the present and you kind of keep going back into the past and then back, you know, to the present and back into the past. And they're just natural repetitions, I think, that happen. So Meander Spiral, I think, is helping me form this one, hopefully for the last time.
And did I hear that there's a spiral staircase in the house itself?
Yes.
Ah, great.
I know it's almost too much. I have to take out half the times I use the word. Like, that's too obvious.
I love it when the universe is telling you you're onto something. Yeah. Any last minute words of advice for writers that you've provided so much today, but is there something else you want to leave or impart to writers out there?
The only thing I can think of, honestly, it's because it's a book that I can't believe I have survived this long without having read. And it's one of the very early books by one of the founders of the Ulipo movement. And I have it hidden somewhere in my house, but it's Experiments in Writing by Kenno, Q-E-N-E-U. And it's incredibly funny. And he takes the same incident, which is seeing a man on a bus who has an altercation and then seeing the same man a few hours later. And a tiny incident that gets one paragraph of treatment, and then he gives himself 150 different exercises on how to rewrite it. And it's really fantastic. So I'm sorry, I will write in later maybe and correct the name and the title, but I think anyone wanting to write should read this book because
fantastic.
Thinking about the whole nature of writing, mostly as a fantastically playful, fun, and inventive thing to do.
I love it. I love it. I haven't heard of that. I will look that up. Jane Allison, Sarah Markser, and I thank you so much for taking the time today. This was really fun.
Thank you, Marie and Sarah. I really enjoyed it.
That was Jane Allison. The book Meander, Spiral, Explode, Design and Pattern in Narrative is out and available now. That's all the time we have for this week. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.